This is Jean Shinoda Bolen, Women of Wisdom, 17 February 1995.
I read her new book, Crossing to Avalon, and I was real inspired by her personal journey, or her midlife story. In her midlife, she went on a pilgrimage, and that's talked about in the book, and she incorporates her her journey with the pilgrimage, with the Holy Grail, Miss of Avalon story. And it's a wonderful book, and I felt compelled to call her and join us and be our opening night speaker. So we're really grateful to have her. She's a Jungian analyst and psychiatrist, a professor at the University of California Medical Center, nationally known psychiatrist who worked within the American Psychiatric Association to change policy and attitudes towards women. Gloria Steinem described Dr. Bolen as a practical expert organizer in the here and now, a gentle revolutionary whose healing, calm, and accepting spirit will testimony to the best, to the better world that a feminist revolution might bring. Her colleague, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, acknowledged in Women Who Run With the Wolves, acknowledged her as a clear and stalwart Madre de Alma who set many examples. She's the author of The Tao of Psychology, Goddesses in Every Woman, Gods in Every Man, and Ring of Power. Let's give a warm welcome to Jean Shinoda Bolen. I can't help but think of a story that I recently was told as the battery or whatever it is getting fixed. But we are all in a place where we are making our own crossing to the realm of Goddess, and we're all in a place in our psyches and in our lives where we get intimations of what has been missing from our culture, from our lives. And I recently heard a story that is really a joke with a principle about what might have been missing for a long time. And I hope it's not too irreverent. But in this story, a woman went up to heaven and had an opportunity to talk to the Virgin Mary. And there was a question that she had that she had been having for a long, long time, because whenever she went to church, she would see statues of the Virgin and Child. And over again, she noticed that Mary was looking rather sad as she held her divine child. And so this woman, having the opportunity finally to ask this burning question to Mary, as to why, as you hold your baby, do you look so sad? And Mary said, I was expecting a girl. Well, can you hear me now? Terrific. Well, at least it's working, so it just needs to be turned up. Can you hear me now? Terrific. Thank you for your welcome. I was really touched by it. I was also amazed at just the energy in the room, and I was humbled by the realization of how much energy and how much heart and time and effort and vision has gone into this, so that I can walk in here and talk, and you who have come in, who haven't been part of the planning, can come in and be part of this week. There's something about the experience of being provided for, of having a place that is a mother principle, that has this quality of being welcomed. And I am touched, and we are all grateful for your vision and your work. Thank you. Crossing to Avalon, the title of this talk, is the title of the last book that I brought out into the world. And from the time that I wrote my first book, about a decade, actually longer than that, 1979, books have had the ability to be like children. You spend a lot of time incubating what it is that you're going to bring out into the world. You spend a lot of time living in preparation for bringing what you have to say out into the world. You deliver a manuscript to a publisher, and it used to be that it would take 9 months from the time you delivered a manuscript for the book to actually make it out into the world. And then a book moves through the world like a child, and that is that you don't know who it's going to meet, what influence it's going to have, what friends it's going to make. And to hear you welcome me tonight, I feel like some of those books have gone out there and made a number of friends, and that's wonderful. The last book, Crossing to Avalon, was a book that I lived and wrote along much before the book came out into the world. That is, I wrote the first draft in 1986 after I had gone on a pilgrimage. And then I put it aside and waited for the right time for me. I realized that it hadn't to do with the manuscript itself, though it did need more work. It had to do with me and my readiness to be a more public person with parts of my life that were very private. And that combination of being a person who, by virtue of family, that is, raised in a Japanese family, one does not go into the world and speak about one's personal life much. And then if you've had a training as a psychiatrist with a psychoanalytic background before becoming a Jungian analyst, you know you never say anything about yourself to anybody. So there were quite a few experiences and inhibitions and fears, really, to share my story. And yet, there's something about the story that we have lived that we can share. That is the only way that we can describe the experience of how it is we know whatever it is this is that we refer to and experience and know as goddess or as goddess spirituality. The realm of transcendent divinity, which is the realm of God and the realm of prophets and the realm of revealed kinds of truth where someone goes on a mountain and comes down with something and passes it on, is the kind of experience that is transcendent and of the spirit mind. But the realm of goddess is something that is not articulate. The realm of goddess is something that, in my experience, has an element of being embodied and being very personal. It's as if what we know of the goddess comes through people in human experiences where the human and the divine meet in a sacred or holy moment without dogma, without words. And in our culture, it has not been remembered. So it seems to me that it is up to us to remember our own sacred moments, find the words to bring it forth, and as we do, we birth goddess spirituality into the culture. We birth the piece of it that we have known, and by bringing it into consciousness, we will help change the world. Because we are at a liminal time in our culture where patriarchy and hierarchy have really brought the planet to a point where the combination of pollution, of exploitation, of war, of disregard for the sacred element that is present in nature and in us has been so disregarded that we really are at this point in history in a very, very dire time. And what if it is up to us to remember and bring across consciousness into the culture that was dismembered from the culture 5 and 10,000 years ago. And that is an awareness of goddess as well as God and all that it means. So my talk is really about bringing forth some thoughts, some experiences of what goddess might mean, that you might remember your own. It's also about how we get to a point in our own lives where we no longer look outside of ourselves to some outside authority, but a time when the knowledge that we carry about what really matters and what we're here for has to come from within. And I think of this as essentially a midlife experience. And I think of midlife as a state of mind, not necessarily a particular chronological age. Midlife is a time when you've lived long enough that you have a real sense of how fast time goes by, and you know that you have lived at least half your life, and it's gone by zip. And there is a time in midlife when there is a whole sense of time passing. And the questions, what did we come to do? What did we come to learn? What are we here for? What truly matters to us comes. And we need to go inside and into our own experience to have an understanding of what that might mean. For me, at 49, I left a marriage of 19 years that I thought would probably last for the rest of my life. But it didn't. And I changed, and I moved, and I left that life behind and came into that place which happens whenever there is a major transition. That is, we enter a liminal phase of life. And a liminal phase of life, which is a word that comes from the word limen, or limen, in Latin meaning threshold, it means that you have left the life that you knew, or the period, or the phase, or the person that defined you, or the occupation that you thought was who you were. And without it now, you are in a period of transition. You've left behind who you used to be, and you are in that in-between place at the threshold of the next phase of your life. At the threshold of the next phase of your life can be a short period, or it can be a long descent. Sometimes people talk about those transitions as dark nights of the soul. Sometimes that transition period is one in which you make a descent to go down and remember, reconnect with dismembered aspects of yourself, and come up again. And in that in-between place where change happens inside, you prepare for the next phase of your life, and you go through the liminal phase and go into the next phase. Well, whenever there's a major transition, you enter a liminal place where what happens next depends a lot on the work, the descent, the experience of being in this place in between. It's as if in this place in between, potential for change, potential for growth, for depth, or potential to lose it and to become cynical or to become so disheartened that your body expresses its despair in some way that contributes to a down spiral that you may or may not recover from. So midlife, liminal times, transition times are major experiences for the psyche or for the soul. They're also potential turning points where, especially at midlife, there is an invitation to go inside. I have used the metaphor of journey and travel and path in everything that I have written before. And this particular experience was one in which all the metaphors still work, but the change that I experienced had a lot to do with taking an actual journey, going on not a metaphor pilgrimage, but a real pilgrimage to sacred sites in Europe. The invitation was a really unusual one. I was in this liminal phase, which from a psychic standpoint is open. And when you are in a transition and have a sense of not knowing your way, that is, having a period of in which there is a sense of being lost. You had a clear path up to this point, and now you are in this place where you don't know what's going to happen next. These are times when very often major dreams happen, vivid dreams that are archetypal may occur. And they are also times when significant potential meetings or invitations can come. And I know for me, synchronicity has played a major part in my life. It's like in the first half of my life, I think that my dreams were much more vivid as to giving me messages about what was happening in me and what the themes were and what the journey was about. But somewhere in my midlife years, I began to realize that synchronicities or meaningful coincidences between something that was growing in me and an outer experience became much more vivid as markers to muse about. Well, I was in this phase of being in between when 1 year to the exact time of that personal experience that was for me the end of that previous phase of my life. So 1 year later, I get an invitation from a woman that I had never heard of nor met before, who wrote and invited me to go on a pilgrimage to experience, as she said, my spiritual sources. And I learned that this invitation had come from a series of events that had to do with Goddesses in Every Woman. That is, Goddesses in Every Woman had been published shortly before when a woman came from Glastonbury, England to visit San Francisco and was given a first edition of my book. And she took it back with her to Glastonbury, where she happened to finally be reading it when Mrs. Eleanor Dedeker, who was the person who invited me on this pilgrimage, came to Glastonbury, picked up the book, and got from the book a sense that she had an assignment to invite its author to Europe. Now, she happened to be a person who had the equivalent of her own foundation that she ran in a particularly personal way. That is, she would get a sense. She'd been doing this for some 10 or 15 years and had been sponsoring individuals or organizations or projects based on some kind of inner guidance that let her know that this particular thing was her assignment to do. So she picked up my book and asked to borrow it, took it with her, and out of that came this invitation. Now, Glastonbury, England was a significant name for me for a number of reasons. One, some 10 or 12 years before, I had had a significant dream. And the associations to that dream by my analyst was the question, had I ever heard of Glastonbury? The dream was of having gone underneath the main part of a church to find that there was a secret room below the church where there was not buried, but in a crypt, a image of a knight or a king. And at Glastonbury in England, the remains of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere were believed to have been found underneath the ordinary level of the Great Abbey. So I had had this in mind because I had not heard of Glastonbury before that. And then in the year prior to my going on this particular pilgrimage, I had read, as many of you may have read, Marion Zimmer Bradley's book, The Mist of Avalon. It was a very unusual experience reading that particular fantasy. It was a book based on Arthurian legends, but told from a very different perspective. That is, it was told from the perspective of the women in the story, as if, at the time of Arthur and at Glastonbury, the realm of the kingdom, the patriarchy, the king and warrior was coming in to the culture in the form of Arthur and Patrick. And at Glastonbury, it was still possible to cross through the mist to experience the realm of the goddess, which was Avalon. And the story told the Arthurian legends as if the story of Arthur marked the time in which patriarchy and patriarchal religions came into the culture and goddess faded further into the mist. Now, historically speaking, that was not so in terms of the timing, but historically speaking, it was so in terms of human experience. At one time, we did have a culture where there was goddess and priestess and healer, where there was a time when nature and seasons and life and midwifery were all part of the human experience, and it did change. Women and some men who read this fantasy novel, which was quite different from the many science fiction fantasy novels that Marion Zimmer Bradley had written, had the experience of reading a book that was true, not in terms of factual accuracy, but in terms of emotional reality, and in terms of touching on an archetypal story that we were remembering when we read the story. And I have long written using myths that have lived on for thousands of years, as the Greek myths have, and as the Sumerian myth of Inanna has. 5,000, 7,000 years ago, stories were told that live to this day. Now, the reason they do is because we do recognize the truth of the story. In the same way that we are fascinated when someone tells us a powerful dream that they have had that's archetypal. It's a personal dream, yes, but it has a transpersonal or archetypal sense to it, and we listen to it. And we are caught in the awareness that the dream at some level is something we know. It's in the language of symbol and metaphor. And at some level, the psyche or the soul speaks this language well and knows when a story is true. And so there was this experience with this fantasy novel. We read it and we had a sense that it was speaking of a time when goddess and priestess and healer were part of the culture. And in this story, it was of alternative realities. It was as if at Glastonbury in England, there was a potential way in which you could still cross through the mists. In the story, the last priestess of the goddess could call the barge and cross on that barge from Glastonbury to Avalon. And when I read that book and thought about the Arthurian legends from this different perspective, it made me think of another legend of that time that had made a tremendous impact on me, but now I saw it from a very different standpoint. I thought of it from the standpoint of the women in the story and thought of the symbology anew. And that story was the story of the Grail legend. Now, most of you have had some sense of the Grail story, but interestingly enough, even if you do not know the details of the story itself, there's something about the notion of the Grail and going on a Grail quest that touches us. The first story of the Grail was essentially about a young man named Percival who was raised in the forest by his mother. The reason she raised him in the forest was because his father and his brother had been knights and had died being knights. And so this mother, wanting to keep the youngest and only remaining child alive, brought him into the forest to raise him away from civilization, away from knowledge of knighthood, away from knowledge of warfare. And there he was raised in the forest. And one day, when he was at that point a young man, he happened, and I think, of course, these happenings are these synchronistic meetings, but he found some knights that had gotten lost and were now in his part of the forest. And when he saw them, he was struck by what he perceived as their beauty, and he came running up to them and said, "You must be angels." And they laughed at him and thought he was a little bit of a fool. And he explained that his mother had said the most beautiful beings anyone could ever hope to see on this earth were angels. And at that moment, what he was experiencing was an activation of the archetype that was him. This is part of the experience of being on our own particular journey, is that when there is an archetypal pattern that is deep in us, we may not be raised to recognize it, but when it comes into view, there is something in us that leaps up and feels the beauty and the being drawn to this because it is part of our own archetypal story. And so this was true of Percival. His mother would have kept him from all of that, but as fate would have it, knights entered his part of the world, and as soon as he saw them, he was drawn to this being his particular path. And he wanted to know how you became one, and they told him about Camelot and knighthood and winning fights and gaining armor and getting mentors, and he, on knowing that it was possible for him to be one, without a backward glance at his mother, went on his first half of life journey, really, to be a knight. Now, many people, if they're lucky in their first half of life, are drawn to something that it's possible to become. It might be that it was to be an artist. It might be that it was to be a mother or a wife. It might have been to be a professional of some sort. But if one is lucky in one's first half of life, there is a being drawn to that fate, that occupation, that relationship that has its roots in a deeper archetypal aspect in our psyches. And this was true for Percival, who set out on his journey to be a knight. And when you are good at doing something, because that's who you are inside, you do have a natural gift for it, which he did. And fate is often on your side, which it was. And so he found himself a mentor. He won his spurs, so to speak, in struggles with other knights, and won armor and won recognition, and eventually did become a knight himself. Now, this is a first half of life story that is a little unusual, but has that successful feeling of you got to be what inside of you wanted to be. There's a short myth called about Procrustes and his bed that is a myth that really applies to everyone and is certainly a first half of life story. In this story, basically very simple, if you're a person on the road to Athens, you pass Procrustes and his bed. And he placed you on his bed, and whatever part of you did not fit, he just cut off, whack. And if you were too short for the bed, he stretched you as if on a medieval rack until you fit the bed. And one way or another, you conformed to this form on your way to Athens. The theme of this conference is about remembering. The story about Procrustes and his bed is about how we all got dismembered on our way to Athens. Athens being the destination that we were set out upon by family and culture. It's what every one of us, one way or another, were placed on our particular road to Athens. That is the expectations of family, the expectations of school, the assumptions of what a little boy should be like, what a little girl should be like. And on the way to Athens, certain aspects that don't fit, that don't conform to what it is that others expected of us, are cut off, dismembered. Because any time there's a part of us that is not welcome into the world, whenever a parent, a schoolyard person, someone who has some influence, says to us, you don't mean you like that, or you don't think you're going to do that, or whatever it is that it is, if someone makes us feel ashamed of something that is in us that is quite real and strong but doesn't fit the Procrustean bed of others' expectations, we cooperate with the experience and cut ourselves off, dismember ourselves on the road to Athens. And very often, in the first half of life, people do not live their personal myth out of fear that no one can make a living doing that, or out of fear that you have to get married, or out of fear that you must have children, and don't do something that isn't on the road to Athens. By midlife, we have either succeeded or failed at these tasks of the first half of life, which really have to do with occupation, career, and relationship. We have done it or not done it, and we have succeeded or not succeeded, and somewhere around midlife, there are the questions that have to do with remembering that which we are dismembered from. And anything that we have repressed is still alive in the psyche. The unconscious world is a world of great potential. It's a shadowy world because we don't allow what's there to see the light of day until we bring it up into consciousness. So in the unconscious is not only everything that we have cut ourselves off from because it was too much to bear, because we were ashamed of it, or because it never had a chance to grow. That is, the underworld realm is a realm of negative shadow, positive shadow. It's everything that is down there that has not been allowed up into consciousness and allowed to develop. So back to Percival. Percival happened to stumble across the archetype that was him, and he got to live it out. Now, if you were an intellectual person, or if you were a musical person, or a very athletic person, if you had a natural capacity to dance, or whatever it was, and if you never had an opportunity, it wouldn't be developed. But once you had a glimpse of whatever it is, that is deep within you, there is a sense of recognition and remembering something and having a sense of how it personally is meaningful to you, even if it has no value on the road to Athens. And whenever we reclaim, reconnect with something that is authentically our own and know it, the knowledge is a knowledge that is not intellectual, but is very much like the word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, from the Gnostic Gospels. Gnosis, when you have a feeling, intuitive, personal connection with divinity or the sacred, as the Gnostic Christians defined it. You know, not from revealed word told to somebody else, but because you experience it in yourself. So there's a whole realm of what it is we gano. What it is we intuitively feel, sense as being true for us. And whenever we are doing something that is deeply meaningful to us, not outside of us, but from some very substantial part of our inner selves, then we can become so absorbed in the experience that we totally lose track of time. And this brings up one way of knowing what it is that is true for you, what really deeply matters to you, is that when you are doing that, when you are with it, when you are absorbed, there is a sense of kairos time, meaning participation in time. The Greeks had two words for time, chronos, named after the god who swallowed his children as soon as they were born. Chronos is the word that chronometer, which means watch or clock, comes from, and it's about measured time passing, and there's never enough time when we are clock watchers. And whenever we are observing time passing with chronos time, there is a sense of scarcity. Most of us, in the responsible adult years of our life, spend so much of it in chronos time, and there's never enough of it. It's our week at a glance weeks, you know. And then there's kairos time, the word meaning participation in time. That's that experience in which we are totally absorbed doing what we love. T.S. Eliot's line is, music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but we are the music while the music lasts. That's a quality of being absorbed in a sacred archetypal moment that has to do with who you are and what is deeply meaningful for you. Well, Percival, to get back to the basic story I was telling you, did the warrior side of his life very well, and then got to the point where, having won it, having done it, there comes a time when there is now space in the psyche for something new or something remembered or something that wants to have expression in you to start stirring. And it was at this point, having succeeded at his task, his occupation, he wondered, whatever happened to Mother? And it was with Mother in mind that he set out to return to the forest to find her. Now, I think this is also the story about patriarchy and patriarchal culture, that there may come a time, as with Percival, when culture, through individuals, begins to remember Mother and wonder what happened to her. So Percival set out, and he took the long road down to the river, which was easy enough. And then there was this vast river, and on the other side was this large forest. And somewhere in that forest, Percival felt was the way to find his way home to Mother. But first he had to find a way to cross this river. And there didn't appear to be a way to cross in any direction. And just when he was about to despair and give up, he noticed that there was a small rowboat with two figures in it, and there was a man fishing in the boat. And he called out to him to ask whether there was a place to cross. And the fisherman said, no, there's no place to cross for 20 leagues up and down the river. But if you want a place to stay tonight, you can stay at my castle or my home. And what you need to do is go up on that bluff, and then you can see it. So Percival went up on the bluff, and he looked, and he could see nothing but forest. And he thought for a moment, I've been made a fool of. And he started to get a little angry. And then he kept looking, and it's as if... One moment there is a sacred dimension to your life, or a mystery, or an underlying oneness that tells you you're connected to everything in this universe. And the next moment, you don't see it at all. It's gone. That shift in consciousness is what many of us have experienced. And so very often, it's when we're young, before we got on the road to Athens in a big way, before we went on to higher education and had the left brain dominate how we perceive things. Often at 8 or 9 or 7, or sometimes just around those idealistic, poetic days for some of adolescence, there is a connection with a sense of oneness that underlies everything. For me, it was an extroverted version of the experience of being out under the stars one night at summer camp and looking at the shooting stars. And somehow there was that moment in which the looking at stars up there shifted. And I think it had something to do with awe and beauty, because awe and beauty and love are part of a sacred dimension that shifts our psyche into a different place. And so here I was at 7 or 8, looking out at the stars, and at some level of gnosis, I had that momentary awareness of the great mystery that I was connected with all that vast universe outside of me. And then I read Frederick Frank's book on artist meditation, and he wrote about how when he was about 7 or 8, he was walking along a country road with fields of curly kale growing on either side of him, and it began to snow. And in that moment, he had that insight that everything out there was inside of him. And he had that insight of the senses merging. So what he heard and what he saw told him that it was all out there, and it was all part, everything out there was part of everything inside. And this was one of my first experiences of the Tao, which I wrote of in the Tao of Psychology, and Viktor Frankl's experience, which was the introverted experience. So there is that kind of remembering, of reconnecting with a different way of looking at experience when you go into it from a different place and become one with it. And at that point, it's always Kairos time. And there is an element of being in touch with whatever it is that is this mystery that is beyond what the ego knows. And one moment, it's one reality, and the next moment, there's a shift. And this was what Percival did. One moment, he saw nothing but forests. And on an ego level, he thought they were making a fool of me. And the next moment, he made the shift, and he saw the castle, and he found his way there. And as he came into the castle and was welcomed there, changed his clothes, and then went into the great, vast, large room, he saw the king of the castle, who turned out to be the same man that was in the rowboat, the Fisher King, who was wounded and could not rise to greet him. And he apologized that he could not rise to greet him, but he was more than welcome to come stay in the castle and have dinner with him that night. Now, Percival came in, acted as if he could not notice that there was anything wrong with the Fisher King, and then joined him for dinner. And with every course, the Grail procession went by. And it was a very interesting procession. And in some of the versions, it's a long one, and there are many versions of the Grail story, because the Grail story is one of those archetypal stories that the personal experience of the symbolic level of the psyche is in guided meditation, where if you are open to the experience, often what comes up from the psyche is your own personal symbology. And yet, as personal as it is, in that it's archetypal, others can relate to it too. It's as if we know that language, the symbolic language. And what I would like to do for just a short time is invite you into the symbolic realm with a short guided meditation. Now, I understood I could wave at somebody up there and have the music from the fairy ring be the background for the guided meditation. So if it could be played, I would invite you to journey seems about right. And if you'll close your eyes and make yourself comfortable, music fills the room. It's as if the sound is like the molecules of air that we breathe. It's as if the music is felt as well as heard. Inhale, as if the music touches our skin. Surrounds us, fills us, touches us. Us. And as we take in the music, we relax, become comfortable, become receptive. Open. And knowing that the more relaxed you are, the more receptive and open to this experience you can be, let yourself breathe in the music. And as you take it in, slowly breathing in and out, let yourself relax more. Take, if you want, 3 slow, deep breaths in and out at your own pace, knowing that as you do so, you relax more and become more receptive to your own inner world. Like a dream, where the symbolic world can be known. And if your psyche is willing, you can start by sensing that there is a mist or a fog that you can cross through to a green and sunny realm on the other side. And as you emerge into this sunlit green place, you have a sense of serenity and beauty, and you can now notice what the sky looks like and what is growing around you. And you are part of nature here, and it feels so safe. Somewhere few steps away, you note that there is a very special tree. Something about the tree is beautiful and healing for you. And you make your way towards this tree that may look quite familiar to you, or may be a tree that you are seeing for the first time, but you're recognizing how special it is to you. And you may find yourself under the tree, sheltered by the tree. And if you wish to be for a moment part of nature herself, you can touch the tree, hold the tree, and let yourself merge and become for a time the tree itself. And now you are aware of your trunk, of the strength of it. You're aware that there are roots reaching down into the earth. You're aware that it's possible to draw nourishment out of the earth itself through your roots up into your tree. And you feel life moving in you. And you sense or feel or intuit your branches and your leaves and how they reach up to the sky. And this moment you feel so much a part of this tree, a part of this planet, a part of nature. And you have such a sense of belonging here now. And you may even feel the breeze or feel your leaves, your branches moving with the wind. And you have a sense of how all nature is part of a universe of which everything belongs. And now let yourself separate from the tree so that you're yourself standing by this tree. And every one of us, there is a witness to the life that we have lived. And every one of us is an observer who knows us really, really well and who feels nothing but compassion for us. And this observer can come to you now in any form that your psyche creates. It might be a wise person. It might be a child, it might be a symbolic creature, it might be an animal or a bird. But let your psyche bring forth in some form that is yours the witness to your life, who knows you very well and who has nothing but compassion for you. And this witness that you are meeting now may give you something, may speak to you and say something to you now. You may receive a symbol, or you may receive words. This figure that is a witness and observer to your life may take you into the past to some moment in which you felt a sense of the sacred, a sense of being part of something greater. You may find yourself remembering a sacred moment. And now if your psyche is willing and you want to, you will have a memory, an experience of a moment in which you felt loved. It may have been when you were a child or an adult. And as you feel this moment of being loved, you might sense that in the center of your chest, there is that heart chakra that opens, that loves, that receives. That can overflow, that is like a chalice. And in this moment, you have a sense of your own beauty. You have a sense of serenity. And another image may come to mind, a gift from your own psyche. Something that is from your soul to your observer self. Whatever it is, like anything that comes from the realm of dreams, it may be something for you just to note and bring back into the waking realm to be reflected upon. Then come back into this room, into this place where this evening we are community, where in this place we are remembering and connecting and learning. And gradually open your eyes, feeling rested, feeling comfortable, knowing that you might dream tonight. And then if the lights would go up, looking at you all, there was such a sense of beauty in the quiet. So for a moment, I got to be the eyes of Mother looking at all you beautiful people. So we need to end this evening and come back again tomorrow, if that is what you're going to do, or the next day, or the day after that, or whatever. But may the goddess be with you. Namaste, which means the divinity in me beholds the divinity in thee. Namaste.